ways people in the West have viewed those in China have changed greatly over the past 150 years, thanks to the evolution of communication, photography, news, and movies. In large part, fashion and traditional forms of dress have helped to shape opinions and thoughts on culture and politics on the other side of the world. From the queue, or the man's hair braid, to the women's suit known as the qipao, to the so-called Mao suit, each form of fashion has come to represent unique eras in U.S.-China relations. Sean Metzger, assistant professor of performance studies at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television, explores this topic in depth in his new book, Chinese Looks.
One of the things that's been interesting to me is the way, what kinds of new fashions are marking China today. So I think about things like the amount of Gucci you can purchase in Shanghai, for example. But I'm also curious about, for example, Captain America. I had just read in the paper that that film topped box office charts. And I think it's so ironic that an American superhero in the Stars and Stripes was suddenly doing so well at the Chinese box office. It seems like 30 years ago that would have been an absolute impossibility. And today, that sort of seems to mark one direction of Xi Jinping's Chinese dream, right? This idea that you can realize something that's not exactly, but not quite dissimilar to the American dream, but you do that within a Chinese context. So I'm curious to see what kind of new clothing people start to wear in China. And I would just return to one of the opening images in my book from 2005, a Newsweek cover with Zhang Ziyi, the actress, in a qipao-like top over a blue jean. And that kind of hybrid image, to me, suggests or anticipates Xi Jinping's drive for a new Chinese dream today, something that's not quite formulated, something that's between the West and something more traditionally Chinese. I think those are the kinds of questions that I hope my book opens up for other people.
Well, certainly over the past century, the qipao has really been an iconic dress that many of us can identify with as Chinese. And even to this day, in traditional weddings, it's used.
Yeah, that's right. And the qipao emerges in the 1920s and 1930s as a kind of equivalent to what men were wearing. So before the 1920s, men wore, as a traditional costume, a kind of long gown called chongpao. And that long gown was a contrast to what women were wearing, which was kind of a long tunic and loose pants. So as a kind of way to make women more equal to men, as women started to enter public discourse for the first time in China, they came up with this new dress, the qipao. And the qipao then, as time went on, became much more form-fitting. The hem went higher and higher and higher. So its original sort of political connotations became much more about women's sexuality, particularly in the Cold War period. So in the Cold War period, of course, that meant in Hong Kong, because only in the beginning of the Maoist era in China could you wear a qipao for official functions. After that time, the Maoist government denied women the ability to wear non-Maoist uniform costumes for official events. So, and then that dress was in vogue for 50s and 60s, very, very provocative with its associations with, for example, the world of Fuzi Wong, which I talk about in detail, which made it really a kind of fashion trend in the U.S. and in Europe, because that play went, and then the later film, went not only through the U.K., but also through the U.S. And like many fashion trends, it fell out of favor, and then was only sort of revived in the late 80s and early 90s.
So many of our stereotypes of the Chinese come from fashion and the dress and what we see in movies and film. And let's talk a little bit about the beginning of your book and the queue.
One of my readers actually had said the queue actually appears in lots of cultural productions that depicts the end of the Qing dynasty. So anything that's set, you know, in from basically 1644 to 1911 in China is likely to depict queues. But in the U.S., that was a little different because we don't have so many epics about, you know, the Taipings fighting the ruling feudal powers or whatever. So what I noticed was that the queue kept recurring in very particular contexts, and that context was at first melodramas that depicted the Western frontier in the U.S., and then that morphed into what we know as the Western, the film that is. So that became the arc of the chapter.
The Mao suit is quite an interesting entity of its own.
One of the interesting things that I found out when I was doing my research was that Maoist clothing varied quite a lot. But when the outfit started to register for the U.S. public, and to some extent the European public, people consolidated the variation in clothing in under one term. So whatever people were wearing, they ended up calling it a Mao suit. So that could be like boiler suit for people working. It could be there are very famous depictions of Mao, you know, with his white shirt and his sleeves rolled up going to work. All of those things ended up getting called the Maoist uniform, even when the jacket wasn't present, which I found interesting. And again, there were variations throughout the communist period. So I think it's interesting that in the West, we have tended to say, oh, Maoist uniform is so much about conformity. But in fact, there's quite a lot of variation among the different outfits that people were wearing during the Cold War in China.
The fashion really became polarizing in terms of how Westerners viewed it. It was either good or bad, considering who was wearing what.
To some degree, you still see some of that discourse play out. What I thought was interesting was the qipao, of course, was selected in the Olympics as the sort of official garb for people presenting medals and for many Chinese officials at functions. And that, again, is sort of a marker of Chinese opening, even as the opening ceremonies of the Olympics showcase all of these very different national costumes that people might wear.
You also go into a chapter called Mao Fun Suits, which sounds like a fun chapter to talk about.
Because I work in sexuality studies partly, and also because a lot of people have made different arguments about the ways that Chineseness in the U.S. is always bound up with questions of gender and sexuality, particularly for male figures. I think sexuality has been a very vexed question for the Chinese-American male. One of the things I wanted to inquire into was how did those sexual stereotypes play out in different historical moments? How were Chinese men linked to different kinds of sexual discourses? So the Mao Fun Suit chapter was a lot about playing with those kinds of stereotypes. I noticed there were a whole bunch of artistic projects that were just that. They were just experiments to see what kinds of meaning might be produced by these different kinds of discourses circulating around China and Chinese costume.
Sean Metzger, Assistant Professor of Performance Studies in the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television. He's also the author of Chinese Looks, Fashion, Performance, Race. It's published by Indiana University Press.